Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn more about the PNWA, you can go to pnwa.org. Well, so first of all, let me just say the Blog Talk Radio is experiencing its periodic disobedience. I hope that this show is understandable to everybody. If not, if we have to end it early, well, so be it. Such are the vicissitudes of the internet. But assuming we can forge ahead, I am happy to report I have the one and only Christina McMorris on the show. Christina is the author of four novels now, including most recently the page-turning historical, I won't call it an epic, it's not quite that big, but it's an historical, it's a lovely historical story filled with characters and family and adventure and love and loss. And she's here with me now to talk about it. Christina,
hi.
Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, it is a pleasure. Christina, as we were saying earlier, this, all right, as I mentioned in my intro, this is your fourth novel. And, I interviewed you for your first book, which was Letters from Home, yeah. And as I recall, that book was written, that was your first book length anything you'd ever written. Isn't that right?
Right. Yeah, I fondly refer to that as my first and my 12th novel because I rewrote it so many times before it actually made it to print. Thank goodness for all those poor readers. Yeah.
Yeah, but you had a lot. I mean, that was a huge learning curve because you're not a typical writer. Here's the typical writer's journey: they grow up and they just read like crazy, and they keep a journal and they write, and then somewhere in their 20s or 30s or 40s they start writing novels. But you really came to writing more as an adult, although you did some writing, but it wasn't like such a big preoccupation for you early on.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right. I think that those people, those typical writers you're talking about are the ones that I was really envious of about around draft number 9 of my book.
Yeah.
Because I figured out how far behind I really was and how blissfully ignorant I was when I decided to, hey, I'll just write a novel. And World War II shouldn't be that hard. Oh, my goodness. So, but, you know, like almost anything that we all do in life that we're so proud of after the fact is, you know, we look back and think, thank goodness I did not know what I was fighting off, because otherwise I would have been smart enough to run the other way. So
that's right.
That's the good news. Yeah, absolutely. So once you're in it, you know, 9 drafts in, you're kind of too late. You know, you think, well, I already wrote it, so I might as well just try to make it the best I can. And so, yes, I was the accidental author who was really more of a movie buff than anything. I think I was always a storyteller in a different venue. And so I grew up in television and films and whatnot. And so for me, I loved movies and storytelling and visual. When I decided to write this story, it was only because I was inspired by my grandparents' World War II courtship letters that my grandmother suddenly revealed that she had had all those years in her closet. And I thought, wow, this would make such a good movie, as you might recall me telling you before.
But I decided,
you know, I think I'm going to, it'd be easier than doing a full-scale cinema production. I will go ahead and write a story and make copies at Kinko's and give it to my kids someday as a Christmas present. And that really was going to be it. It's that one-hit wonder in my own small town or family, just in my household, really. But once I got into it, I figured out how much I enjoyed it and then really wanted to share it with people. And then started figuring out how little I knew, of course, and had to do a lot of reading to catch up and a lot of writing exercises and being brave enough to hand out those horrible drafts to friends who were kind enough not to just bleed with red pen all over them. So, I always say
Christina,
you need like a... Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you are... You are made of some, you've got some serious stick-to-itiveness in you, because to take on a novel and 9 drafts, 10 drafts, 11 drafts without having had that lifelong commitment to it, because that's normally where writers come from. Boy, I'm so interested to hear kind of where that came from, because so many people would have given up after a draft or two when they realized, oh, Jesus, this isn't nearly as easy as I thought. But having not, but usually what keeps the writer going is they've just always been writers and they've always wanted to do it. And I got to finally do it and I'm going to get through no matter what. But you came to it rather innocently and yet you stuck it out through so much. What's in your blood, woman? How do you do it?
Well, I think a large part of it is that first, my mother was so supportive from day one. So when I called her, maybe we were both so blissfully ignorant, but you also had this unconditional love for your child, apparently, that when they are the tree that stands still for an entire play, you think they're brilliant. So when I called and said, I think I'm going to write a novel, she said, oh, I think you should. So, you know, you think, oh, okay, I think I can do this. I think I had a lot, which I think every, not just writer, but every person who is trying to work in a business that is centered around the arts, because it is so subjective and so competitive and tough. As you know, there's so many people, so many critics. Everyone is a critic today, so you can be torn down so easily that I think you need, in my view, what I've learned through this whole experience is you need cheerleaders who think that everything you do is wonderful and that you have to keep going because you're so good you cannot give up. And then you need the more realistic, you know, people who are giving you constructive criticism so that you can reach your goal. But I think in those gaps in between of those drafts, you need those cheerleaders who are encouraging you to keep going. So that's a lot of what helps.
You know, I think you're right. I think that writers need those cheerleaders and those critics. And I think in a way you need both of those people in your head too. Because I think when you sit down to write, you've got to have a voice saying, come on, Christina, you can do this. You're awesome. You love the story. You know you can do it. Right. And then you've got to have another voice saying, is this the best? Could you maybe do it a little? Could you find another way to say it? Is there, and you need both really in you. But but you absolutely have to have a cheerleader that wakes up with you in the morning, because there's plenty of reason to doubt that this will ever amount to anything, seems to me.
Absolutely. No, especially, and I'll say with The Edge of Lost being the latest novel that you think, oh, it's supposed to get easier. Every writer knows, I'm guessing by your 20th novel, you still think it's harder than ever. So with this novel, it was such a challenge because I was stretching outside of my comfort zone of World War II. I was going into the Depression years. I was going into Brooklyn, Italian and Irish immigrants and Ellis Island and Alcatraz and all of these topics I had never covered before. And in my house, my husband just really kept, he was kind of the headlights, I always say, like in the fog. So I could only see 10 feet ahead of me, and I would have panicked if it weren't for having a support like that saying, no, you're good. All you need to know is 10 feet ahead. That's it. And then you'll figure out the next 10 feet as soon as you get there. So that's how I made my deadline.
Wow. I'll tell you, Christina, it may have been hard, but I've interviewed you for 3 of your 4 books, and you have grown, I think, tremendously over those 4 books. And what I've seen in this is, first of all, it was funny. I was reading along, and from like page 1, I was thinking, oh, this poor woman had to research so much. There is so, and it was like page after page with detail after detail. And I thought, oh, what a pain. It's not my thing, but I know what the authors have to do. So kudos. You did a great job in capturing the time.
Thank you.
But let me say this. Maybe you can talk about this. You did a really good job. You came to storytelling from the cinema, and you described your storytelling as being in your, sort of, you picture the movies in your mind, sort of, that it was like what, and I think, which is a great way to tell stories, but what I've seen in your writing, in this book in particular, is you are starting to really understand how you can, the unique things you can do with this format, with the language, because you don't have the movie, so you've got to make it with the words, and I find that your writing is getting even more vivid and more
good.
Flexible. I don't know if you experience it that way, but I experience it as a reader.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Well, I'm definitely most proud of this book in just that the first one is a labor of love, of course, because it came from such a personal place. And it was really kind of a love letter to that generation, but also my grandparents, where this book, I felt like I really got to kind of put together all the skills that I had learned along the way in order to deliver a story that would be a book that I would want to read myself. And I think that's always the test of the book that you should write, right? The book that's not out there that you want to read.
Yeah. So. And you're writing a lot about the immigrant life in America, and you're sort of, I mean, you're the daughter of one immigrant and one, your mom is herself the daughter of immigrants. Am I getting it right in terms of generations?
Yes, her grandfather. Exactly.
Her grandfather came over. Okay.
Right. So my mom's side came from Ireland, and then she also has a mix a bit of from England. And then my dad's side, of course, directly from my dad because he's an immigrant from Kyoto. So having been able to infuse the immigrant perspective from family life into this book was so much fun because I didn't realize truly how much I was going to rely on that until I started reading all these memoirs from Italian and Irish immigrant families who came over in the early 1900s. And I realized how many similarities that immigrant families truly have regardless of culture.
So interesting. Okay, so like what? Like what? Give me some examples of these similarities.
Absolutely. So a lot of what I read is, you can imagine, with Irish and Italian families, it was very patriarchal. And so you have this the father figure that sort of has the last word, that, you know, there's disownment that happens in the families. There's, the mother kind of trying to keep peace in the families, a lot of talking over each other. A lot of that kind of resonated with me of, you know, what I know of the Japanese culture and families, that we still have a lot of family in Japan. So a lot of that was very similar, and that surprised me.
Interesting. And what, when you think of the immigrant psychology of the person who's going to do that, because I am such a homebody. The idea of moving out of state, terrifies.
Yeah.
Well, I won't say terrifies me, but the idea of just picking up and heading for another country. And your father, of course, did this at a young age. He did it on sort of on nothing. What is that psychology? Can you describe it at all? What is that mentality? What is the personality that makes that up?
Well, I think that, obviously you have to be brave enough to do that. I can't imagine even myself doing that. I lived in Florence, Italy for a year during my college years, but I had so much security of going with 39 other students to live in one large villa where our teachers were Italian but would come in and speak English. So everything was very, very comfortable. You know, we weren't much outside of our comfort zone. To go solo and move to another country, or take your children and, you know, and your spouse. And I think the drive is really because you are so confident that a better life is waiting for you and your family. So, that I think was a similarity that ran through all of the families.
And so you grew up, and your dad, but your mom, of course, was fully American by that time. Right. And so you grew up in a household and your dad went on to be a very successful businessman. By the time you came along, was the family already sort of thriving like that, or were they still sort of scrabbling to build the business up?
Yeah, no, we were definitely. I grew up with, our family had very little means back then. So I appreciate everything that we have now. And, you know, the big goal is, of course, to make sure that our kids appreciate everything they have, even though they had more than maybe I grew up with, to not take it for granted. The fact that we can spend $4 on a coffee, which is, you know, of course, insane when you think of it that way. I'm a Northwest girl, so, you know, that's our everyday run is Starbucks. Yeah. But not everybody can afford that, you know. So those things that, you know, we really try to instill appreciation for all of those. When I was born I would say my father was a karate instructor, was his main occupation, and he was a world referee in karate. So so we grew up with that, and it wasn't until, you know, my parents decided we had not enough money to give away Christmas gifts that they started making, you know, Yoshida sauce, which, you know, of course, they just called black teriyaki sauce at home, and made it in the basement or made it in their kitchen. and started giving away as gifts. So to answer your very first question, a lot of, I think, my drive comes from coming from an entrepreneurial family as well, that you know those obstacles are in your way, but as long as you keep your eye on the goal, you'll get there if you just keep trying and you don't give up.
You know, the entrepreneur and the author have tremendous amounts in common, I think. And in a way, an author is an entrepreneur, really, because every book is like your own business, don't you think?
Yes, so true. Yes, absolutely.
And you know, and for some authors, that's very challenging. They don't, the business end of it just about floors them. And I teach a class just trying to help authors, trying to help the introverted author, which you are not. You happen to not be one of those, but a lot of them are. And but that side of it, I don't think intimidates you. You're someone who seems to understand the marketing and the social media and that side of it. Have I read you correctly, or does that bug you too?
No. I think you're spot on. I think that's where it makes me a little different, and maybe that is partially what my first book, because I also understood the marketing side. And I looked forward to that part. So I thought that was actually the fun. I thought that was the fun part.
Oh my God. All right. You're the first one. You're the first one, Christina, of any author I've interviewed. Look forward to that. Okay. Well, good for you. Well, you came along at the right time. You know, 20 years ago, there was nothing for an author to do. Now it's all on your shoulders.
Right. It's so true. The only thing that I will say that is, you know, it's become sort of a downside. Well, there's both. There's pros and cons to it both. But doing the social media aspect has grown so much since I published my first book back in 2011. I guess it wasn't that long ago, but it feels like it because, you know, I sold it in 2009 and it came out in 2011. Right. So and over the years, I've seen the marketing change a lot. And it's just this fine line of being online all the time and trying to invite readers into your life and not sound like an infomercial all the time, but you also want to let them know that you have a book available. So without, you know, making it sound like you are just the sales, oh boy, there she is again, sort of, you know, and so trying to find that balance, I think it's something all authors online are really trying to find.
And I'll tell you, a lot of what I see is infomercials. A lot of what I see is just, hey, my book's 99 cents, go get it. Hey, you know, I got another romance novel, whatever. I think it's a really, I'm not sure. And in fact, I don't know. I'd be curious to hear your opinion on this. I don't know how effective social media actually is. I know that's like almost heretical at this point, but I don't know if it actually is. Do you think it is in your experience of using it? Maybe I don't know how to use it that way. I mean, in terms of marketing books, marketing classes and stuff, I kind of can do it. But what do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think that for a long time now, last couple of years, and publishers pushing authors to really be online.
I know.
Retweet this, post this on this day.
Yeah.
And then you hear other people, you know, I think I've heard through the grapevine that Donald Moss at several conferences has shared a little tidbit, which was your circles online are, you know, on social media are much smaller than you think. And that in some ways is liberating. What I do know is most of the push from my publisher and I for the first just week of launch, since the book just came out last Tuesday, is a lot of social media right now, because then other things are taking off as of December, which is, you know, which we are finally in now. But up until, you know, but sales have been better than any of my other books so far. And so I do think that the social media has helped a lot, but I've, you know, been very selective and only mention it more as finally letting people know it's available. A couple posts, a couple tweets, and I'm calling it good, and letting them spread it around if they feel so inclined. But I think once you post a few times, the same people are seeing it over and over again.
Yes.
And I think it's more of a turn off than anything else. I think if they're interested, they're familiar with it, or they will buy it, or they will hear it then later from friends who have read it and enjoyed it. I think that's still, to this day, word of mouth is probably still the biggest push.
And in fact, the first piece of marketing advice I ever heard was from Donald Moss, which was at the first writers conference I ever went to. And he said, I was kind of a newbie to this, that side of it. I've been writing for a while, but it was the first kind of dealing with that end. And he said something that stuck with me, and I still think it's true, which is most books are sold word of mouth, because having an author tell you, hey, I got a new book, it's awesome, it's going to be less convincing than if I tell you, hey, I just read this book, Christina, you're going to love it, you should pick it up. Now that's a compelling piece of marketing, and there's no way you can replace someone else telling their friends how great your book is. And
no, absolutely.
We can't quite control that. But, well, that's so fascinating. Oh, look at this. Christina, we have a caller, and I'm pretty sure I know who it is, and he wants to ask you a question. So I'm going to. Is that you, Jeffrey?
Okay. It is, Bill. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my question again, Bill. You do it every time. Another fabulous, super interesting interview.
Oh, thank you.
Christina, I first want to wish you unparalleled success with the latest novel, Edge of Loss. Keep at it. Five, I'd like to read the 10th soon.
Oh, thank you. Well,
it's
you know,
a page turner.
Home is my 12th draft.
It's a page turner, Jeffrey. You're going to love it if you haven't already.
I know. Bill alluded to the fact that writers most desire to grow as authors as they continue to write and publish additional offers of novels. My question is really, was it an epiphanous or an aha moment per se of insight into your own writing craft, which you discovered in the process of writing your very first novel that's found its way into and throughout your subsequent books?
The question is, was there something specific that she discovered in her first book that has stayed with her ever since, kind of?
Yeah, and really was effective in writing the next novels or comfort level.
I see. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I'm going to put you on hold for that answer. So that's interesting, Christina. So was there something that lit up for you or that you came to understand early on that first book that has stayed with you ever since?
Yeah, I'd say that, yes, I will say that the male points of view in there was only one male point of view in Letters from Home and three women's point of view. And they alternated throughout the book, as you know. So when I hit the male point of view chapters, I realized those were absolutely my favorite. And
really?
I could write those all day. And I thought they were the most effortless. And, you know, my husband and I always joke that I'm the one that can go to bed angry and I would rather not spend 5 hours talking about my feelings. You know, so we joke about a reversal of roles. Kind of like I'm such the man. So I think that comes through probably in some of my writing in that I enjoyed the you know, quick wit of the men, and I really love the action scenes, the war scenes from the World War II books. So that, I think, has, you know, in every book, I think I've added a little bit more male. And then finally, in The Edge of Loss, what I discovered with that is I really love the suspense chapters. And so I think the suspense and mystery, as you know from this last book, is probably the heaviest in this novel because it's what I enjoy writing and also reading the most. So that this book, of course, took over and it became a completely male point of view, which, you know, I felt like that is exactly what this book needed to be. I almost had it go back and forth with the original premise of kind of jumping in time for present day sort of or 1950s and jumping back to 30s and having a female point of view that was discovering a mystery. And I decided that as a reader, I would want to skip those chapters. I would just want to get back to the historical and the male point of view because I liked his journey more. So that's when I decided, you know, I was going to not do that at all and just write the story I'd want to read.
Interesting. That is fascinating. I think there might be a suspense novel in your future, Christina. Like more pure type suspense novel because this one really cooked along. You know, it had that pace to it. Even though it's very historical, obviously it's steeped in that time, but it has a real, you're evolving. Do you see how you're evolving? Isn't it interesting?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right, though. I think I keep leaning a little bit more toward that way. And the only thing keep me back probably from writing a just straight suspense novel is that I love the historical period so much. So ever since I read Water for Elephants, because I had 20 friends plus friends say, you have to read this. And of course, you know, it came full circle and Sarah Gruen blurbed this book. And that was probably
a huge
highlight because she's the reason I stuck with historical fiction in the first place, or I wouldn't have written more than one historical fiction book. So that was fun.
But you know, so this is interesting. You wrote your first book because you found these letters from your It was from your grandmother? Was it your grandmother's letters, right?
Right. So she saved them from my grandfather. Exactly.
Right. Okay. So you found these letters and this inspired a story. But that, you know, that was how it began. It didn't begin because you were sitting around reading histories over and over again. But now you stuck with the historical. You bounced to different times. Does that surprise you that you're that interested in history? Had you been a huge history buff growing up? I don't think you were you?
No, I wasn't. I probably would have preferred to sleep through my history classes in high school. And now, you know, now you regret it and think, gosh, why didn't I pay attention? I'd be so much more, so much farther ahead now. You know, I think with the World War II, I always loved, of course, the fashion and the music. Who doesn't? And then those fantastic World War II uniforms, you know, that every woman likes. but you know, besides the USO dances and the very movie-oriented view we have of World War II, anyway, that you know is much more romanticized, I'm sure, than real life. I always loved that, and the Rat Pack music and all of that, but. Other than that, no, I wasn't. I was not a History Channel watcher, which I am now, of course.
You are?
But I think what happened.
There's no history on the History Channel, so it doesn't matter.
That's true. Well, Alcatraz just came out, so that was exciting.
That's right. Okay. Oh, good timing. Yeah.
Yes, it was. Oh, my gosh. But I think what changed was that I, reading my grandfather's letters, who passed away 20 plus years ago, you know, it humanized it all. And you realize they were young just like us. They dated just like us. They, you know, and where it felt very distant, and elderly people looked like elderly people to me. And now they look like people who once were young and did amazing things in an incredible time. So I think that's the difference. And now that I read those historical texts and they're real people that would have been just like us.
Yeah. That's right. They're people. That's the thing about history, that sometimes when history is taught, that's the part that gets left out, strangely, is that they were still just people walking around, scratching their heads and picking their noses and falling in love and saying stupid things. It was all happening then, too. It wasn't just all on a grand scale. Well, that is fascinating. Oh, well, look at this. Time has flown by, as I feared it would with you, Christina.
Yeah.
And so The Edge of Lost, it really... listeners, it really is. It's a page turner, and it's very interesting. And I encourage you to go out and pick up a copy, either at your local bookstore or online. I'm sure it's everywhere books are sold. But I'm not done with you yet, Christina. I have one more question for you.
Okay, I'm bracing myself.
I'm sure prepare yourself. I've asked you this before, but I think I love how the answer changes because it seems to. So. Finish the sentence. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you?
Okay. Well, I think that aside from paying attention more to other people around you, like I said about seeing not just the surface of what you see on people, but more of what's underneath it. So who they maybe used to be, who they could have been in another life if their circumstances were different. You know, that I think it's changed my view of especially people that I don't know. So when somebody cuts you off on the freeway, instead of being really angry, you may get frustrated for a second, but then I stop and think, there's a reason people do everything that they do. And that's what I think you have to get to as a writer. That's what makes it tolerable to write the most unlikable characters, because you understand why. And so otherwise you better not be writing them. And you have to feel something for them. And I think that's what it's taught me a lot is you figure out that person who cut you off, you know, is racing, that's playing pole position on the freeway. There's a reason they act the way that they do, or the reason why someone's rude to you that day when you don't know, you know, when you're confident you didn't deserve it. And it helps me be more patient with that, because you think, you know what, they have something going on in their lives that I don't know about. And that's what I write as a character.
You know what that's called, Christina? That's called compassion.
I love your answer
because I agree with it so much. And also, I do, because I have said for years that the number one thing, if a writer has nothing else, they must have compassion. That compassion is your greatest tool. And it really is. It really is. What a wonderful answer. Well, Christina, I can't wait to see your next book. You're just getting better and better. And I expect nothing less from you the next time. So good luck. And I guess you're doing one a year. So I guess I know when the next one's coming out. Yeah.
It's like a baby. Just pop them out.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I can't wait. Well, Christina, best of luck. All right.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Compassion. She's right. You know, she's absolutely right. It does teach you to say, basically, Everyone does something for a reason. Everyone believes they're doing the right thing. No one does something for just no reason at all. They don't do something just because they're wicked. They always believe they're doing it makes sense given their lives and what they're going through. Beautiful answer. Well, next week, boys and girls, I will be doing the show at a different day and a different time because I have a very special guest, Bernie Siegel. The wonderful Bernie Siegel. I'm going to be on the 9th. So it's going to be on Wednesday, the 9th, and I'm going to be doing it at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern. So that's next week. Instead of on Tuesday, I'll be on Wednesday, for those of you who like to listen live, at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. Until then, go do something you love with someone you love. It's all that life's about.